Welcome to the Let's Talk Energy podcast from EnergyNet. This series was recorded at the Africa Energy Forum 2023 in Nairobi, Kenya. Join us for this and other episodes as we talk to the industry players, stakeholders, and rising stars of Africa's energy sector.
Hi, my name is Anne Mae Dittman. I'm the portfolio manager for the Climate Finance Partnership, which is a blended finance vehicle that is managed by BlackRock, which is the largest asset manager in the world. I sit in the BlackRock Climate Infrastructure Team, which is a team of 65 professionals that invest in renewable power and enabling infrastructure. And the Climate Finance Partnership specifically invests in emerging markets, including Africa.
Thanks, Anne Mae. I'm John Marks. I'm chairman and editorial director of African Energy, which publishes the African Energy newspaper. We have the African Energy Live database, which contains over 7,500 power projects across Africa, and we do consultancy work. And I'm particularly intrigued to be here today to talk to Anne Mae and hear about BlackRock, because as she said, we have the world's largest asset manager. That's not the kind of character that this industry has particularly known coming to see us over the years. I think that shows, reflects shifts within the industry, and also the shifting role of private equity. There's a lot of private equity people here at AEF, but a huge number of them have at the very least come out of government official financing background. So actually to see the pure money is a very interesting factor. So now, Anne Mae, your fund is a global fund, but it's got a percentage of Africa. Do you want to tell us how it's constituted, how much has been raised, has been committed already to projects, and then we'll go on to see where you think it's going.
Thank you, John. Yes, and you know, your remarks there really resonate, because you're right. You know, BlackRock traditionally have never been in these markets as much as we have now. And we owe this in large part our entree into Africa, specifically due to the Climate Finance Partnership. Yeah. And just to give a couple words on an introduction as to what the fund is, because it is actually really also unique for BlackRock. It's the only blended finance public private vehicle that BlackRock manages, direct equity vehicle that BlackRock manages. And this was done in conjunction with catalytic investors and private investors. Some of our catalytic investors include Proparco, which is the development finance institution for France, KfW, which is the DFI for Germany, and JBIC, which is the development arm for Japan, including some leading U.S. impact institutions as well. And they provide this catalytic portion of that blended finance vehicle. And then that money, that investment that they made in this fund, mobilized a huge amount of private capital into these markets. So one of the ways in which we brought private capital into these markets, you know, I think you're alluding to this in your remarks, is that catalytic capital. So we're really pleased to be able to deliver this fund on behalf of our investors. The fund focuses on three regions. It's a global fund, as you mentioned, but three regions. One, which is Africa.
Yep.
The other, which is Latin America and Caribbean. And the third being APAC, really Southeast Asia. And the African commitment piece of it is a minimum of 25% committed to the AUM of the fund to Africa, and the fund is $673 million, so close to $700 million of AUM.
So setting up the fund from a BlackRock perspective, as you say, it's a climate fund and it's very different. What came first? Was it the fact that BlackRock felt it had to come in and get a climate fund, or was it tempted to, was it saying, well, look, there's a lot of DFI action, there's a lot of what people might call philanthropy around there. I mean, we're seeing some really big entrants, as you say. What was the actual, the original point of departure?
That's a really great question. And that is where the beginning of our journey is, right? So back in 2018, at the One Planet Summit, our CEO, Larry Fink, together with President Macron, conceived this idea. They basically said, look, there's a problem. The problem is that there is so much to be invested in these markets, and including in Africa. But we don't have as much private investment in there that we need. And honestly, when it comes to achieving net zero globally, we can't leave emerging markets behind. I mean, they not just because they have the largest demographic growth, but just because you cannot actually only have OECD markets achieving net zero and the emerging markets not, and somehow we've achieved net zero for the planet, right? We're one planet. So it was really at that summit where Larry, our CEO, and President Macron agreed that they wanted to create a vehicle that combined public and private money to try to tackle some of this and invest in these markets that are the most vulnerable to climate change, but also have a really compelling financial mission as well for our investors. So we were really pleased. I mean, it's a great question because you're right. Like, you don't just wake up one day and it's just there. And it's not like normal private equity markets where, you have regular way investors who are interested. It really kind of took this aha moment of, look, we want to tackle this, and let's tackle this together, public and private.
It's an interesting point, of course. So you're saying that that the tie-up with Macron, of course, who's a rare investment banker that's come ahead of state, possibly might have that now in the UK with Rishi Sunak as well, man who made his money in the industry before coming and would understand. I think this is really interesting because when it comes to private equity, we've seen private equity players, including some of the biggest names up on the same marquees as BlackRock are, who've come and more or less come with great fanfare and gone with slightly less fanfare. And it is an interesting thing. May I ask, you've got this group of people. You've got DFIs, you've got the impact investors, and you've got yourselves from extremely commercial private equity. And culturally, how does that blend work amongst the people who are there?
You know, I love this question because one of the things that we're so proud about is that it's not just a blending of financial capital, it's a blending of human capital.
Yeah.
So it's great that you're touching upon this. And because you are working with investors that of different backgrounds, different value set, different mission. And so in order for this fund to be successful is that we need to basically understand each of our value sets and really sort of level set. And one of the things we're really proud of at BlackRock is that the DFIs have been operating in emerging markets far longer than BlackRock has been, right? I mean, they have immense experience, in particular on ESG. And when you're dealing with infrastructure assets, when you're dealing with climate infrastructure assets that are geo-fixed assets that have real implications when it comes to ESG matters, the DFIs are so experienced and they really, I would say, enhanced our process in terms of the ESG risk management, which is so critical for the success of this fund. And so we actually, one of the things that we're really proud of is that we actually have a very specific committee. And in private equity, as you know, it's very common to have an LP advisory committee, an LPAC. That's very, very common where the LPs, your large LPs will advise on certain matters. And obviously there's some conflicts, they will advise on that, weigh in and vote. But this committee is separate from all that. It is singularly focused on ESG risk management and also impact reporting. Because one of the things we want to do is to be able to lead the market together in this space.
And now, as we know, for commercial institutions, ESG reporting has proved an extremely thorny issue. So would you say actually from BlackRock's perspective, the tie-up with DFIs particularly actually has had a very positive, almost kind of knowledge-giving issue?
Absolutely. And one of the things that, to your point, the nomenclature on this is different. The methodologies are different. We don't have any sort of standardized sets in which a vocabulary even that we're using. And you know, let alone, you know, what are we measuring? What is the, what's the transparency?
Great point.
You know, what's the transparency that our investors demand from us, including our DFI investors?
Yeah.
And yes, working together, and so to your point of these different sets of investors, one of the things that the DFIs have certainly been able to help us improve, and also just the talking together is determining, well, what should we be measuring? You know, how should we be talking about it? And how should we be talking about it in a way that also resonates with private investors, so that they continue to want to mobilize into this space?
Yes.
And one of the things we do, just as an example, is we dollarize our impact. Some of the UN SDGs that we align our investment strategy alongside, we measure how we achieve those in a dollarized fashion, so that it resonates more with private investors, so that they can evaluate your fund's performance on an impact level, and hopefully continue to want to invest in this space because of the impact performance in addition to the financial performance.
And because there is the financial performance as well, and you haven't got to be the world's largest asset manager without having a rate of return. Now, many of the people out in the hall here would be saying, for example, for African Power Projects, that the rate of return they're being asked to provide by governments just doesn't make it feasible. The host country here, Kenya, developers are saying exactly that. We cannot get an IPP away because the rates of return are so low. How do you rationalize those two things?
It is extremely difficult because you're right. I mean, we have a little bit of a Goldilocks problem, I would call it sometimes, because we're at a...
It's a bear market.
It is. And also, you know, trying to find things with the returns that you need to meet for your private, your public and private investors, of course, but yet also achieving the impact. So you're now considering a whole host of things. Yeah. And some of the times you have projects that platforms or projects that are too early.
Yes.
And the returns could be very attractive, but a bit too early in their life cycle.
So the actual risk profile is a little bit too high.
Exactly. And then sometimes you have projects that are, you know, fully operating. And while they have good yield and could also be, you know, nice for our investors, it's not creating that development impact that our investors are also looking to grab as well. So one of the things we look at in the portfolio management team is it's a global fund. So one of the good things is that we get to construct the fund in a way where, okay, maybe you have something that's a little, you know, like you said, a little riskier, a little earlier, and then maybe you take something that, because it's so hard to find the one thing that's right in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're hedging. You've got...
Exactly right.
It's
exactly right.
It's an interesting one. Now, perhaps recapitulate on the percentage of Africa you've got within the fund at the moment. And also, are there exceptional problems dealing with sub-Saharan Africa? As you found them, or is it fairly normal? Because actually, you know, doing stuff in India can be hard, or Guatemala. Although, actually, those Central Americans have some interesting successes that possibly could be used to learn from.
No, you're right. I mean, in some ways, all the countries when you're working with developing markets will have particular issues that are specific to that country's political regime, rule of law, currency, inflation. They all have their particular issues that you'll have to work around, structure around, think about. That being said, you know, one of the great things about having a mandate to invest in these markets is that you have to just get over it. You know, I mean, because I think we had the luck when we were investing in largely OECD markets, it's just better understood. And it's not that these issues are not overcomable, but you have enough of a pause, a hesitation, that you weren't doing it. One of the great things about having a blended finance fund with public and private capital in here is that the public funds is helping us manage those idiosyncratic risks that the private investors would otherwise have been hesitant to come into the fund because of that.
Yep.
So we do have the mandate, which is fantastic, I think. And I think the more we can do this, the more we can invest in these markets, and to your point, like Central America, the more we can show that there are successes, then the more investment that can be made into these markets.
And does the fact that, like, you've got the impact investors, how does that work to keep down the cost of the capital?
So it doesn't. It's not quite a capital cost reducing mechanism. What it really is more. It's not a. This is not a terrific way to describe it, but more of a risk buffer, so that the catalytic capital is taking greater risks of. Versus the private capital.
Okay.
But it's not, you know, it's not a completely adequate description.
No,
but they are coming.
Perhaps to explore that then. I've just come. You love my solar project. You love my solar project in the middle of the desert, and you want to invest in it. How within the fund would each of the participants behave? I mean, presumably your team obviously are the ones doing the business, but what would be, how would exactly the input of the three different components work to back my solar project?
Yeah, so it's a holistic fund. So there's not different tranches or anything like that you might be more familiar with on a debt blended finance vehicle, for instance.
Absolutely.
So it's a holistic fund. It's 1-4 catalytic to private capital ratio. So effectively, the catalytic capital absorbs some, not all, some losses ahead, if should they occur, first. So we, of course, are the manager, and we would, of course, diligence manage. One of the things I mentioned with this climate impact committee that we're really proud of, to the extent that we rate all the investments in terms of risk. So in your solar project, we would have our ESG officer together with our consultants rate the risk profile of that project. And if it's a high risk or substantially high risk project, we present it to our catalytic our climate impact committee so that they can give us feedback. So some of this is much more hands-on for a fund. Normally you have private investors who kind of sit back and
you're going to do your due diligence. You're going to make sure you're going to try and find out about that, my dodgy partner that you don't want to know about.
Now I do.
Now you do, exactly. And you would do that level of due diligence, but you haven't got the other level that you would have here.
Yes. Really, and getting their feedback too. So it's not just we do a very thorough ESG analysis, obviously, because, like I said, you know, these markets, the fund is also compliant with IFC performance standards, which is, you know, international benchmark.
Absolutely.
For this. So it is a high level of standards. And we prepare all of this diligence and we present it to our investors who are the most knowledgeable and is able to give us feedback on, you know, this issue I don't like, or, you know, this issue I would manage it in this way. So we're better managers for it, because we're learning, you know, as we go. And there's no better way to learn, as you know, than when you actually have something live before you to work together on. So it is very partnerly partnership.
Absolutely. So just to guide people, this community, people have projects, always looking for finance. It's as there's a cliche that passes around the developer community that actually, we know all the blockages in the system, and very often the blockages down to policy, down to capacity, down to all the issues that we know. But actually, there's enough money around. I'm still never quite sure about that one. And I guess if you've got money, you see a lot of people. So what kind of projects are you doing, just as sort of ideal type? And how would you see the fund going forward, expanding of the projects that you've now supported, set the precedents for where you're going, or there are other areas that you'd be looking at? How far does the idea of climate finance actually go in the number of sectors? Perhaps some just a feel for that would be great.
Yeah, so let me start with just telling you about a couple deals that we announced, because that gives you a flavor of what we've completed so far.
Yeah.
One of our first investment actually was in Africa.
Okay.
We announced that we signed an SPA for the Lake Turkana Wind Project.
Remember it well.
Which, yeah, is a marquee project here in Kenya. So, and we're so pleased to be in Nairobi as well for AEF. So that's like one example, you know, largest wind farm on the continent, supplying, you know, around 14% of Kenya's power. Like that's the type of project that that we invested in. And one of the things that's most exciting to us about that project are the expansion opportunities, the opportunities to do even more at the project site. So that's one. The other project that, or other platform that we announced was that we invested in Clean Tech Renewables, which is in the Philippines, which is a leading renewable developer in the Philippines for up to 1 gigawatt development of solar assets. So that just gives you a flavor of like countries and obviously types of projects. Climate infrastructure is obviously renewable generation, as you know, but we also include enabling infrastructure in that,
okay.
And that includes, you know, battery, grid stability, transmission. So it includes a
so
wider.
You're
set.
There for the next holy grail of African power to invest in transmission.
Well, you know, transmission is really tough because it's extraordinarily expensive. The revenue model, I mean, we could go on to, we could talk about transmission for a long time. That would be incredibly impactful. I think we recognize that transmission type assets are incredibly impactful. It really unlocks the renewable power.
Well, I mean, you're from America, I'm from Britain. Our countries at the moment are coming to the terrified recognition that our own transmission systems don't work, and the incredible amount of investment and problems that we're going to have to do to overcome it. So actually Africa's in the same boat, but it hasn't it's been a difficult model, hasn't it, for working transmission into projects, into generation projects.
Correct.
And so it's difficult.
Yeah, and the revenue model is very difficult because I'm from the U.S., and so, you know, our utilities, they build this into their rate cases. I mean, there's a whole system around how that would be fortified.
Yes.
and how the utilities get paid for that. It's less obvious in the markets that we're investing in.
Well,
but
state's always been the essential and indeed
correct. De
jure monopoly over the system. And funding that is extremely difficult if you want to bring in private finance.
Yes, 100%.
Indeed, if you want to bring in public finance, it's difficult.
Exactly, it's hard enough to do. It's hard enough to publicly finance them, let alone privately finance them. So I think that's very challenging. Our team has invested in climate infrastructure, you know, for a long time, and so. For a dozen years now, and so our team is very experienced in climate infrastructure assets, but not so experienced in these markets.
Yeah.
So for us, what we were delivering for our investors is that asset technology expertise, but it's the new markets that is newer for us. I mean, and not, you know, and maybe that's unfair to say to us because Africa is of course the one that we're least experienced in, but in APAC as well as in LATAM, we have teams on the ground. I mean, we have been operating there for some time, so Africa is probably the one that is the in terms of markets is the newest for us.
In terms of markets, we're coming near to the end of our time, but it could be observed that the conception of a market, if you're an investor, is different from the sort of market that we have here, which is very difficult to invest in. I mean, 25 years of the Africa Energy Forum, and indeed of our own African Energy publication, has seen you know, there was a spike upwards in IPPs in the late 90s when this started, and then it stopped. And getting it back, I mean, your investment in Lake Turkana Wind, which has developed very well, you know, I was delighted to see the change of ownership as well, Eric Granskog coming in, and, you know, it was great. Very important, but there have been so few others. And it is a problem of, I think, do you perceive that the very slow pace still of projects coming out, coming ahead, really makes it difficult?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg, as you're, I think, pointing out. And just to clarify, Eric Granskog is with Milele, that announced their investment in Lake Turkana well. And they've completed their transaction. We're actually still awaiting some conditions to be achieved before we can close on our investment. But we announced that
those are technical,
We have a regulatory approvals, for instance. Yeah. So we have some approvals. It's the usual. We have to wait before we can actually complete. Whereas Milele did close their investment. But you're absolutely right. It's a little chicken and egg, and it's a little frustrating as you're pointing out, because things are moving so slow. It does seem you move a couple steps forward and then you're a step back. And there's a lot of elements to that. There's no one reason for why things aren't moving, I think, as quickly as we all would like. But one thing that I hope is that we can prove out our fund's mission to our investors, and then it will incentivize other investors to be attracted to making these investments as well, both from a financial perspective, but also from an impact perspective. Okay. And then we see more. We just need to see more dollars, frankly.
Absolutely.
And just from a climate justice angle, it's well overdue.
So, last question. Going ahead, where do you see? You see a second fund coming?
I hope.
an enlarged fund, the model coming, and you'd be interested to see other investors coming in for similar kind of models. It's a real groundbreaking thing that's happened here.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, what we would love to achieve in the long term is that we don't even need catalytic capital. We don't even need public investors. Obviously public investors will always have a role, but they can do it in other ways. There's other enabling things that they can do to support emerging markets platforms and projects in climate infrastructure. But what we would love to see is eventually down the line, you know, emerging market funds that are dedicated to developing markets that are purely private capital. That would be like the dream.
It is. Well, it is. And it's been talked about for so long, but this is where something's happening. And
this is where you have to start, right? You have to start somewhere.
the famous green shoots. Well, thank you very much. Anything else you'd like to comment on? I think we've covered a few bases.
No, thank you. Thank you, John, for the really insightful questions. We're very happy to have this conversation.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. As I say, talking as someone who's been in this industry African-wise for a very long time, it's very nice to see very new classes of investor coming in with some fresh thinking. So, very good.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Let's Talk Energy podcast from EnergyNet. This series was recorded at the Africa Energy Forum 2023 in Nairobi, Kenya. Join us for this and other episodes as we talk to the industry players, stakeholders, and rising stars of Africa's energy sector.